Former President Donald Trump has pleaded not guilty in the Georgia election case.
And we have every right, every single right, to challenge an election that we think is dishonest.
Plus, the military junta in Gabon has named the transition leader.
This is the moment the Gabon junta named General Brice Oligui-Nguema as transition leader on Wednesday.
And dozens of people were killed overnight when fire raged through a five-story Johannesburg apartment block.
And our hearts go out to every person who is affected by this disaster.
Today is Friday, September 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Rick Pantaleo in Washington. Former President Donald Trump has pleaded not guilty and sought to sever his case from other defendants accused along with him of illegally trying to overturn the results of the 2020 election in Georgia. Associated Press correspondent Mike Hampen has this report.
Former President Trump entered the not guilty plea Thursday morning. Trump and 18 others are accused of illegally trying to overturn the results of the 2020 election in Georgia. By pleading not guilty, Trump won't have to show up for the arraignment hearings set for next week. Several other people charged in the 41-count indictment already have waived arraignment, saving them a trip to the Atlanta courthouse. The case and the logistics of bringing it to trial are likely to be complicated. Legal maneuvering by several of those charged already has started. I'm Mike Hempen.
The former president commented on his not guilty plea.
I want to thank you for being here. We did nothing wrong at all, and we have every right, every single right, to challenge an election that we think is dishonest, that we think it's very dishonest. So thank you all very much, and I'll see you very soon. Thank you very much.
Gabon's military junta named General Brice Oligui-Nguema as transition leader on Wednesday following the apparent ouster of President Ali Bongo. Olivia Chan reports for Reuters.
This is the moment the Gabon junta named General Brice Oligui-Nguema as transition leader on Wednesday following the apparent ouster of President Ali Bongo. So who is Nguema? Here are five facts about him. Nguema is from Gabon's southeastern province of Ortogwe. It borders the Republic of Congo. President Ali Bongo is from the same part of the country. Nguema replaced Bongo's stepbrother as head of Gabon's Republican Guard in October 2019. The elite force is in charge of protecting the president, his family and other high-profile figures. Shortly after he took on the new role in 2019, Nguema launched an anti-corruption operation named Clean Hands to crack down on alleged state-led embezzlement. Nguema was named in a 2020 investigation by the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, a global network of investigative journalists. It alleged that some members of the Bongo family and their inner circle, including Nguema, purchased expensive property in the United States with stashes of cash. Nguema himself has not read out any statement, but he was among the officers who first announced the coup. The group, which calls itself the Committee of Transition and the Restoration of Institutions, said the August 26th election was not credible, and that Gabon faced a, quote, severe institutional, political, economic and social crisis. In an interview with French newspaper Le Monde on Wednesday, Nguema said people in Gabon were frustrated with their government. He noted Bongo's ill health following a stroke in 2018 and said the president's run for a third term breached the constitution.
That was Reuters correspondent Olivia Chan. Nigeria has joined a growing number of nations criticizing Africa's latest coup, this time in Gabon. The Nigerian president and chair of the West African regional bloc, ECOWAS, says he is working with world leaders and the African Union to resolve the political crisis in Gabon. Timothy Obizu has more from Nigeria's capital, Abuja.
Nigerian presidential spokesman Ajuri Ngelale says President Bola Tinubu is monitoring the development in Gabon very closely and with deep concern. Ngelale says Tinubu is also worried about the seeming, quote, autocratic contagion, end quote, spreading in Africa and is working with other heads of state in Africa to fix it. Senior military men on Wednesday ousted Gabonese leader Ali Bongo Ondimba shortly after he was declared the winner of last week's controversial presidential polls. He is now under house arrest. In a video on social media, Bongo is seen asking his allies to, quote, make some noise about his removal. The junta also annulled the elections, dissolved state institutions, and closed the country's borders. Ngelale spoke to journalists in Abuja.
Power belongs in the hands of Africa's great people and not in the barrel of a loaded gun. The president affirms that the rule of law and a faithful recourse to constitutional resolutions and instruments of electoral dispute resolution must not at any time be allowed to perish from our great continent.
Gabon's coup d'etat is the eighth in Africa since August 2020 and comes 1 month after a military standoff in Niger that regional bloc ECOWAS, chaired by Tinubu, is struggling to resolve. The latest coup, which the African Union also condemned, raises concerns about the fading of the rule of law in Africa. Coups are becoming more rampant because African leaders have failed to deliver quality democratic leadership, says Rotimi Olawale, an Abuja-based political affairs analyst.
While ECOWAS has a standing reaction to coups on the continent, what the body needs to do beyond response to coup is also to sort of subject the democratic credentials of his member state to a peer review mechanism. If democracy is not working for the people, they will seek alternative means of governance that will deliver the goods for them. And many democracies on the African continent is not delivering them.
Emmanuel Njoku, Director of Democracy and Governance at Connected Development, a non-profit civil society group based in Abuja, says there could be more coups in the coming months. Amid global condemnation, Gabon's junta named General Brice Nguema as the country's transitional leader. The French news agency reports he will be sworn in on Monday. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Dozens of people were killed overnight when fire raged through a five-story Johannesburg apartment block, one of the worst such disasters in a city where poverty, household fires, and homelessness are widespread. Reuters correspondent Lauren Anthony has more.
Dozens are dead after a fire raged through a Johannesburg apartment block on Thursday. One of the worst such disasters in a city where poverty, joblessness, household fires and homelessness are widespread. The five-story building, which now sits gutted and blackened by soot, was still smouldering later that day. Reuters took the following disturbing footage of bodies covered in blankets near the site of the blaze. One distraught, grieving woman was comforted as she sobbed in the street. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa called the incident a great tragedy.
And our hearts go out to every person who is affected by this disaster. And I do hope that the investigations into the fire will enable communities and authorities to prevent a repeat of such a tragedy.
Those who survived the blaze told of thick smoke, with terrified residents jumping from windows to their deaths.
I don't have a place to stay, and all things is burned inside. Food, whatever, the cloth, you know. But I just say that because I'm still alive, thanks to God. But about my things, TVs, whatever, is burned.
Everything's
burned.
Documents,
my passport, even my ID, everything.
The building, in a rundown area of town, was owned by municipal authorities. But 12 hours after the blaze broke out, those authorities were still unable to provide a clear picture of who had lived there. The city's mayor said the municipality had leased it to a charity for displaced women, but that it had, quote, ended up serving a different purpose, without giving further details. One official said some of those who burned to death may have been renting from criminal gangs who were operating illegally. Edward Malopi, spokesperson for research and advocacy group, the Socioeconomic Rights Institute, says that the city has been absent in taking responsibility for its properties.
A large portion of the buildings in the inner city are actually not in a good state, but they are actually inhabited by people who are desperate for housing that is closer to work opportunities. The city has always been there. They have never been absent in all of this, but they have been absent in the runnings and of the buildings and their properties. And so they have also contributed to some of these conditions by effectively not taking effective ownership of their properties.
The cause of the fire is still under investigation.
That was Reuters correspondent Lauren Anthony. We're following these other stories from around the world. Pakistani officials said Thursday that a motorcycle-borne suicide bomber struck a military convoy in a remote northwestern region, killing at least 9 soldiers and wounding several others. Some analysts warn that the choice of countries selected for induction into the BRICS bloc suggests the growing may be headed on a path toward decreased tolerance for public dissent and debate. On August 24th, the developing bloc announced the admission of Argentina, Egypt, Ethiopia, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates into its group. Polar bears have long symbolized the dangers posed by climate change as rising temperatures melt away the Arctic sea ice, which they depend on for survival. A new report published in the journal Science on Thursday shows it is possible to calculate how much new greenhouse gas emissions will increase the number of ice-free days in the bears' habitats, which will affect the percentage of cubs that reach adulthood. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Rick Pantaleo. UN Secretary Antonio Guterres spoke to reporters Thursday about a letter he sent to Russia about reviving the Black Sea Grain Initiative.
We presented a set of concrete proposals in a letter I've sent to the Russian foreign minister. We presented a set of concrete proposals allowing to create the conditions for the renewal of the Black Sea Initiative. We believe that the Black Sea Initiative has given a very important contribution to make the food markets more adequate to our objectives of food security. It has brought down prices. It has created conditions for access to the global markets of many countries, namely in the developing world. And we believe it would be extremely important to renew it.
Believed to be the fifth largest military force in the world, the Russian army has not been as successful in Ukraine as President Vladimir Putin initially hoped when he invaded the country a year and a half ago. Ani Chikwadze talked to U.S. experts about Russia's military strength. Anna Rice narrates the story.
When Russia invaded Ukraine in February 2022, Russian President Vladimir Putin promised he would capture its capital, Kyiv, in 3 days. 18 months later, that still hasn't happened, despite the Kremlin spending over $60 billion on the war effort, said Gary Schmidt of the American Enterprise Institute, a Washington-based think tank.
Everybody was looking at basically the amount of money that the Politburo, that the Kremlin was throwing at the Russian military and saying, well, that they're going to have real capabilities.
Atlantic Council strategy and security expert Ian Brzezinski believes the invasion of Ukraine was designed as a short-term campaign that has now dragged into a defensive brawl.
A year and a half ago, they were on the offense. And an offensive operation is always a lot more difficult than a defensive operation. Now they're on the defense. They've been given, unfortunately, a lot of time to dig in and establish fortifications and minefields and trench lines and such. It's not a world-class fighting force, but it's still a significant force.
Today, the Russian army amounts to about 1 million soldiers. Schmidt says that because of its losses in Ukraine and despite its mobilization, large parts of the army are not ready for combat.
They were once a juggernaut when it came to armored operations. And it turns out that, again, without combined operations capabilities, without the logistics necessary to carry that out, and without the sort of combined use of air power, that juggernaut just doesn't exist.
Brzezinski says the August 2008 conflict in Georgia exposed weaknesses in discipline, command, and structure within the Russian military.
But it was, you know, a dismal performance. And Putin vowed that he was going to change things, and he embarked upon a 10 to 15-year military modernization plan.
Today, Russia faces a manpower problem in Ukraine, and bolstering troop numbers alone won't help and won't be easy, says Philip Bridlove, a retired U.S. Air Force general who was NATO's top commander from 2013 to 2016.
If you think Russia is completely done, I think you're wrong. There is a lot more capability, but it would take a huge political lift for Putin to continue to call up forces and do some of the things that he might have to do.
The experts VOA spoke with say they are waiting to see how Wagner fighters respond to the death of their rebellious chief, Yevgeny Prigozhin, in a plane crash believed to have been orchestrated by Putin. For Anya Chikvadze, NRI's VOA News.
A day after a strike reached deep inside Russia, Ukraine's president has said his country has developed a long-range weapon. Associated Press correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
The statement by President Volodymyr Zelensky was an apparent reference to the previous day's strike on an airport in western Russia. Zelensky said on his Telegram channel that the weapon was produced by Ukraine's Ministry of Strategic Industries, but gave no other details. A day earlier, a four-hour wave of drones hit an airport on Russia's border with Estonia and Latvia. Moscow blamed the attack on Ukraine. I'm Karen Chamas.
Israeli police and medical officials said a Palestinian truck driver has killed an Israeli soldier and injured two others in a ramming attack on a checkpoint on the boundary with the occupied West Bank. Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder has more.
A Palestinian truck driver rammed three Israeli soldiers near a checkpoint, killing one of them. Israeli police and medical officials said on Thursday. The police said the attacker was shot dead in the ensuing pursuit. The military said three soldiers were injured in the incident on the boundary with the occupied West Bank. A medical official said one of them died. They were heading home on leave and the driver made a U-turn to run them down, also lightly injuring a roadside vendor, the military said. Israeli police said the driver, who was 41 and had a permit to work in Israel, was shot by pursuing forces outside the nearby Palestinian village of Ne'elim.
A terrorist used a vehicle that was not his to arrive here at the Maccabim crossing and drive and hit and run three soldiers. Now, after he managed to injure these soldiers, he then proceeded to the Hashmonaim crossing, where he was neutralized by the guards who were there.
The Islamist militant group Hamas, which has stepped up attacks in the West Bank, did not claim responsibility for what it called a heroic operation. The West Bank, among areas where Palestinians seek statehood, has seen a surge of violence in recent months.
That was Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder. The Panama Canal has been slightly impacted by climate change and an El Niño-induced drought, leading authorities to impose restrictions on vessels to keep trade and the canal flowing. From Panama City, Oscar Silabaran has the story, narrated by Veronica Villafania.
A crucial waterway for trade, the Panama Canal links the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. But Panamanian officials say the two main freshwater reservoirs that feed the canal are well below optimum level. That's due to the increasing effects of climate change and drought-caused El Niño, a weather phenomenon in the Pacific Ocean that has reduced normal rainy season rainfall. While the canal remains functional, the daily transit capacity has been lowered from 38 vessels to 32. Administrators have also imposed weight restrictions and encouraged vessel owners to reserve a crossing time to avoid delays.
We are continually notifying our customers to reserve their slots or participate in auctions so they don't have to wait in transit. And they are aware the canal capacity have been reduced by 6 to 7 ships per day.
a siete barcos diarios.
The low water levels and conservation measures have produced a backlog. There are currently more than 100 ships waiting to cross the Panama Canal. The United States is the canal's main partner and client, followed by China, Japan, and Chile. Serving as a shortcut between Asia and the eastern United States, the canal plays a pivotal role in global trade. Panamanian economist Carlos Arauz is worried delays and restrictions will hurt an already strained supply chain.
During the pandemic, freight rates shot up by almost 70%. In other words, everything was costing 70% more. These freight rates had been adjusting to pre-pandemic levels. The current situation is making them shoot up again, not to pandemic levels, but prices could be impacted between 12 and 18%.
The Panama Canal Authority, the government agency responsible for overseeing canal operation and management, has said the weight and transit restrictions will remain in place at least for the next 10 months. Canal operators worry the already low rain and canal water levels will get worse when Panama's dry season starts in December. And long-range predictions suggest next year's rainy season could also bring a lower-than-normal rainfall. For Oscar Sulbaran in Panama City, Veronica Villafañe, VOA News.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, this is Rick Pantaleo in Washington, wishing you good day, good health, and good news tomorrow. And have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Not satisfied with hounding democracy advocates into exile, Hong Kong authorities are now harassing their families. In 2019, Hong Kong and Chinese authorities took a number of steps aimed at tightening Beijing's control over Hong Kong. Despite the fact that these actions contravene the 1984 Sino-British Joint Declaration, which stipulates that Hong Kong is to be self-governing, with a high degree of autonomy. In response, thousands of people rose up in massive protests that lasted for months, but ended soon after the Beijing-imposed national security law, which outlawed public dissent of any sort, came into effect in July 2020. Since then, 260 people have been arrested in Hong Kong under national security-related charges, and dozens fled the country. But the officials in Beijing are not satisfied with stifling protests in Hong Kong. They are targeting critics around the world, particularly expatriate advocates for democracy. In early July, Hong Kong police issued arrest warrants and bounties of nearly $130,000 each on 8 activists who live abroad, but who nonetheless continue to advocate for democracy in Hong Kong. They are pro-democracy lawmakers Nathan Law, Ted Hui, and Dennis Kwok, lawyer Kevin Yam, and activists Finn Lau, Anna Kwok, Elmer Yuen, and Christopher Meng. In August, National Security Police raided the family homes of at least 4 of the activists, brought in more than a dozen family members for questioning, interrogated the ex-wife, son, daughter, and daughter-in-law of one activist, and the parents and 2 brothers of another. This deliberate campaign to intimidate and silence individuals for exercising their human rights and fundamental freedoms is a further step in the erosion of freedoms in Hong Kong. This is also a form of transnational repression to intimidate and silence individuals abroad and to coerce their return, said State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller in a written statement. The United States strongly condemns the Hong Kong authorities' ongoing harassment of family members in Hong Kong of democracy advocates living overseas, who are being targeted simply for their association with their loved ones, he said. We call on the Hong Kong authorities to cease all harassment of the democracy activists' family members. We also call on the PRC government to respect the rights and freedoms of people in Hong Kong, as guaranteed by the Basic Law and the Sino-British Joint Declaration.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.